Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
You pop craze youngsters, and welcome to part two of episode 71 of Chart Music. I'm Al Needham, that's Taylor Parks.
Not a lot.
And here comes Neil Kulkarni.
I'm here.
And we are about to embark upon the episode of Top of the Pops from March the 19th, 1981, which was a very magical time, wasn't it, chaps?
Oh, yeah. Oh. What a wonderland it was that we were living in.
Yeah, we all put on our Pierre costumes and threw bricks at the police before waving Union Jacks for our dashing prince and his lovely new wife before being made redundant. I mean, without question, chaps, 1981 stank of unwashed cock, and the only good thing about it was the music.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
As we'll find out. All right then, pop craze youngsters, it is time to go way back to March of 1981. Always remember, we may coat down your favourite band or artist, but we never forget they've been on Top of the Pops more than we have.
Hello, welcome to yet another edition of Top of the Pops.
It's 20 past 7 on Thursday, March the 19th, 1981, and Top of the Pops has entered its ninth month under the reign of Michael Hurl, and business is booming. It's been knocking on the door of the top 10 most watched broadcasts on all three channels all year, and while this episode will pull down a mere 14.9 million viewers on a par with Crossroads, Open Or Hours and The Professionals, next week's episode will bag 19 million on them. Oof. Which is Coronation Street numbers, and I have no idea why.
A third of the population, pretty much.
Yes.
It was all we had, that's the thing, it was all we had.
Yeah. I bet it was raining that night.
Pop music TV-wise, it's currently the only game in town, with only the old grey whistle test and a few late-night regional efforts knocking about. And the only new music programme that ITV have in the works at the moment is Moondog's Matinee, which is another Muriel Young Kids programme hosted by a band from Northern Ireland, which featured the likes of Chaz and Dave, Rockpile and Andy Fairweather Low. Not only that, but Top of the Pops is also going through a very rare period where it's not being coated down in the media. Even Clive James found time to mention this episode in his TV review in next Sunday's Observer and said that one of the acts on tonight's show, quote, uncorked the best pop single in years. It should make you feel good about life for about 3.5 minutes.
Ooh.
I'll leave it there for now.
A mystery from The Godfather.
Is it as good as Dog Shit in My Garden, I wonder? The period of guest presenters, pop news and surprise micro-interviews that flared up after the technician strikes is long behind us. But chaps, we're still a long way from the Yellow Hair era. And judging by this episode, the show is absolutely crying out for a revamp, don't you think?
Very much so. It's not looking 80s yet. Frequent moments in this episode where if you'd have been told, you know, this was from 76 or something, you could have well believed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few attempts to make a few little changes. It's not really happening yet, is it?
So your host tonight is Peter Powell, who is now 3.5 years into his career with the BBC and nearing the peak of his career there. He's currently firmly embedded into the drive time slot from 4:30 to 7 p.m. on weekdays at Radio 1, which means he gets to break down the new Top 40 in full every Tuesday. That was important, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, yeah.
I've banged on many a time and off about nipping out to spend it on my lunch break on Tuesday afternoons to get the first news from Gallup. But later on, we're going to hear massive chunks of the new Top 40, which was really important, man, wasn't it?
Very important, yeah. I mean, let's be honest, 81. I mean, this, for me, was a time before the big emergence of commercial stations on the radio. So it was Radio 1 constantly. And this was a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, his voice, Peter Powell's voice, is as associated with that rundown as it is for me in 81 with his advert for Chart Hits Volume 1 and 2 on KTEL,
yes,
which is a big memory of Powell from 81 as well.
Tonight, he finds himself as the meat in a hairy sandwich as his show takes over from Travis's afternoon slot and then hands over to Wheels, the hour-long show about motorbikes presented by the living Nash Abadj himself. Not only that, but tonight's episode, which is being broadcast right now on Radio 1, features Dave Taylor, the wheelie king himself, putting a new motorcyclist through his paces and giving him tips on how to break into the sport of motorbike racing, a certain Peter James Bernard Powell. Fucking hell. All up in your area. He's already been lined up for a stint on the Radio 1 Roadshow, including an appearance at Carlion Bay in Cornwall, where the advertising in the local press will announce that there's also free access to the Paul Gever Naturist Bay. Thank God it wasn't Travis's week to do the roadshow. And along with Dave Lee Travis and Simon Bates, he'll be holding down a summer DJ residency at Tiffany's Ballroom in Blackpool, going head-to-head with a rival discotheque, who will be hosting DJ slots this summer by Martin Shaw, Lewis Collins and Dennis Waterman. Taylor, you'd go to professionals disco, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine the calibre of ladies who'd be turning up at that?
With Cowley at the bar fucking moaning that they're not playing anything ever.
Yeah, all those ladies either wearing designer jeans or calf-length skirts and kitten heels.
Mm. All of whom die before the end of the night to terrorists, no doubt.
Yeah, but, you know, whatever, there'll be another one along in a minute.
By the way, chaps, do you know who officially opened Paul Gever Naturist Bay in 1971? I found out during my research. I was quite delighted.
Ooh, 71?
Someone in the entertainment realm.
Reg Varney?
Oh. Your indicates that Taylor was close there.
Bob Grant?
No.
Arthur Lowe?
Freddie Starr.
Oh, Jesus.
Of course
Christ.
It was Freddie Starr. Sadly, he didn't go about as a nudie Hitler with a comedy swastika painted on his bollock. He was in a nice 70s leisure tracksuit.
Not Freddie Starr hid my hamster.
Freddie Starr smuggled my budget.
Ugh.
This is Powell's 35th appearance as a host of our favourite Thursday evening pop treat, and he reached the summit of his profession when he hosted the 1980 Christmas Day episode, and is still the youngest member of a talent pool currently consisting of Richard Skinner, Mike Reed, Tommy Vance, Dave Lee Travis, and Jingle Nonce OBE. And there's been an attempt by the BBC to place him squarely within the ranks of the Disher. Last week, he appeared in the pages of the Sunday Mirror Women's section as that week's action man, posing in the very latest off-the-peg casual wear. Quote, Britain's most popular DJ, Peter Powell, tells me that after 3 years of having no special girlfriend, he is now in love. Alison is a dancer and model, and I'm both possessive and proud of her, he says. I've never been happier. And you don't know her, she goes to a different school. How could a guy like Peter, age 29, 5'8", with sexy dark eyes, square jaw and fine brown hair, stay unattached for so long? Answer. Peter really stays still long enough for him to catch up. He's on Radio 1 every weekday afternoon. He's a regular on Top of the Pops. He's forever scurrying around Britain doing live DJ gigs. He recently received award for his popularity from Prince Michael of Kent. What's the baseline for that? Being more popular than Prince Michael of Kent's missus? And when he's not working, he's playing football, squash, tennis, or sailing, windsurfing, or skiing. But I did manage to pin him down long enough to model his Top of the Pops among the latest in men's casual fashions. Two-tone beige nylon anorak by Adidas from Top Man at Burton's, cotton shirt and stretch denim jeans by Vidal Sassoon from Way In at Harrods.
That's a strong look.
So yeah, everything's coming up, pal, but it's the last episode he'll ever present in his 20s. Article in the telly pages of today's Daily Mirror. Hitman Peter turns 30. Disc jockey Peter Powell is trying to grow old gracefully. Peter, who introduces Top of the Pops tonight, will turn 30 on Tuesday. I am facing being 30 like an ostrich with his head in the sand, hoping it'll go away quietly, says Peter. So, chaps, from next week there will be no presenters in their 20s until they draft in Gary Davis and Pat Sharp at the end of the next year. Oh, dear.
Yeah. Gosh. End of an era.
Yes.
I love that article where at the start it said, so how can a man like this be single? He's 5'8". He looks like a pre-chewed bolus of bubble gum. So desperately ingratiating that his face is folding in on itself. Mm. Oh, tightly folded bud, the flowers of evil.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird him turning 30. He's going to be 72 this year. I mean, he is 72 this year now, Peter Powell, God, which is mental. But he's still looking good at this point. He's still, you know, looking like the party crasher killer from The Hard Way. He's very, very ambitious, isn't he, Powell?
Oh, yes.
I mean, I read an interesting quote, which might have been mentioned on Chart Music before, of his early ambitions in this interview that I read. Powell said, I've always been interested in business. When I was 17, I was a salesman for expanded metal dung passages for piggeries. It was my dream to be a salesman for ICI. So there you go. You know, ICI's loss is our game.
Reach for the stars.
Yes.
And then I noticed somebody across the sty masturbating a pig. And he got me into Radio 1.
He knows where the bodies are buried, does Powell. I mean, think about think about who he represents now, particularly right now at this moment that we're recording this podcast. The whole Chiswick Mafia, the whole Schofield thing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he knows where the bodies are buried.
But as far as presentation goes, chaps, we know that age brings maturity, and we can see that in Powell, can't we? The perm has been replaced by a sensible haircut, and this is no longer the Mr. Woo Hey of 1977. You know, songs are no longer ace. They're excellent. And the feet are going to stay on the floor throughout this episode, aren't they?
Yeah, but you can tell he's still got his enthusiasm by the way he starts off. Hello, welcome to yet another edition of Top of the Pops. Which I like because it has a sort of desperate, death-haunted world weariness, which is a little bit at odds with his upbeat demeanour. And kind of, you know, he's like a slaughterman smiling ruefully as he slots a bolt through the 45th cow brain of the day, just sealed inside a meaningless, endlessly repeating sequence of episodes of Top of the Pops. We'll be there one day. It's hard to imagine. Yeah. I know.
Oh yeah, but I mean, he could have looked at his older peers at Radio One and slotted into one of their kind of categories, like DLT for instance, but I think he's taking cues from Jensen in being a safe pair of hands at this point.
It is weird with Powell though, isn't it? I mean, he's a man who hasn't aged well. I don't mean personally. Last time I saw him, he was holding up reasonably averagely for a man with a face that's essentially internal, bundled in like a Brussels sprout. But then he was an early adopter of what was then called Keep Fit, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Yeah. What I mean by not aging well is that his legend has grown tatty because he's remembered as a sort of second-tier DJ, isn't he?
Yeah.
But he was a huge name at the time. But he's he's not really up there in the collective memory with well-loved figures like Travis or Bates or Mike Reed or even Gary Davis, right? But at the same time, he's not down in that third tier of cultural amnesia with Paul Burnett or Adrian John or Dixie Peach or me, Mark Page. He's on that sort of middle shelf with people like Richard Skinner or maybe Diddy David Hamilton, the Tony Gubber of music presentation. And with Peter Powell, it's partly because he's not got his own thing. You know, in the 80s, they had music DJs like Peel and Janis Long and Rankin Miss P, Robbie Vincent, and Andy Kershaw, loathe him or hate him. And then they had the supposed personality DJs like Steve Wright.
Yes.
But it's the fools who tried to straddle that gap who've actually fallen into it in the collective memory. Because nobody thinks about these in-between blokes who, on the one hand, were entirely image-orientated, but that image was just, hey, I'm a regular young guy
who
quite likes his music. It was just too bland to be memorable over time. But back then, Peter Powell was huge.
Yeah.
He was a massive star. I mean, he never had the weekday breakfast show, but he must have opened more fates and guested at more provincial Dickie Bo Dorman nightclubs than most cunts in history, and was considered dishy with his beady eyes and pushy manner. And all of that is now gone, as though it had never existed, like the contents of a broken hard drive after the heat death of the universe.
You can say that, but also you can say that he got out in time.
Yeah.
You know, he was never going to be lumped in with the Yew Tree era of Radio 1 DJs because he just said, right, okay, I've done this now, I'm going off to do something else and be even more successful at that.
It's true, yeah. Although the thing about Powell as well, when you look back, he does represent a very specific subset of British men from this period, right? It's the kind of bloke who's very well aware that he's now living in the 80s, even if he's not quite sure yet what that means. Beyond having shorter hair and straight leg trousers, right? And maybe a tight white T-shirt promoting Sandwell Valley Nature Reserve or something, like under the bomber jacket. But he's ambitious and he's positive in a way that didn't really exist in the 70s. That kind of slightly obnoxious but moderately discreet kind of ambition, right? Like, I don't know his politics, although I can fucking guess. You sense that he would not see a contradiction between, like, the go-for-it positivity of the Jam and the upbeat vibe of early Thatcherism, right? Like, he operates in the cultural sphere, but he never really thinks about what culture is or what it means, like, apart from telling John Peel not to play hip-hop because it was the music of black criminals.
Yes.
Because when did they ever make any good music? He's got no ideas, but he respects himself for getting on and making it happen.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. In summary, he is exactly the kind of person who would describe the record Vienna by Ultravox as magnificent.
Yes.
Well, he's a businessman more than a personality, in a way. I mean, you get the feeling, even through his Radio 1 career, that he, ultimately what he's doing is networking. You know, he doesn't really want to foster a future career as the kind of voice of Britain, like fucking Noel Evans or something. I think he just, he's a businessman who happens to have spent some time in his youth, in his salad days, doing this, presenting the most popular pop program on television.
Yeah, he played his hand very well, didn't he?
It's just a hook, like, nowadays he's like, hey, remember this face? Yeah, like a Brussels sprout. But it's amazing, isn't it, when you look it up, the amount of people that he managed, what they musically call talent management, right? He's managed Simon Cowell, Adam Deck, Philip Schofield, and good God, Richard and Judy.
Yeah, yeah.
The television of white criminals. But I looked him up at Company's House, right? And it's quite the patchwork quilt, his record there. I'm not really a business guy, you'll be shocked to hear. But the list of companies that Peter Powell has co-founded or been the president of and resigned from. That list is longer than the string of a stunt kite. One of those stunt kites that somebody else with the same name put their name to.
Hello, welcome to yet another edition of Top of the Pops. And we've got a great show lined up. We've got The Who, we've got Roxy Music, we've got Duran Duran. And if you can handle that lot, then hopefully you can handle this. Because live on Top of the Pops tonight is Sharon Redd, and can you handle it?
We get hit with the merest flicker of the Top of the Pops white on black logo with a blue square border layered atop each other, a conceit they have been using since August of last year and would continue to use until July of this year. And the strains of the instrumental bit of Can You Feel It by the Jacksons, sadly not on this episode. That cold open style that they're going for here, really unsatisfactory.
It's brutal.
It's got an emergency broadcast hint to it, hasn't it? Or back in the day when the adverts came on and the regional logo would flash up.
Yeah,
that's not good, man. And you need a theme tune. You need a clarion call to bring all the youth together.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it ties in with what you were saying. The 80s hasn't really started yet.
They've decided that Whole Lot of Love isn't going to cut it in the thrusting new era.
But they've not replaced it with anything.
No,
you need a theme tune so you can turn it up and wait for the thunderous footsteps coming down the stairs.
Yeah.
Then the screen fills with Powell in a lemon yellow wind cheetah with the sleeves rolled up, a jazzy blue mustard and wine striped shirt with the collar turned up, and powder blue slacks. Oh, new sounds, new styles, eh, chaps?
Ooh, powder blue slacks with a thin brown belt.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, you've got to have an eye for detail with this sort of thing. And introducing the next record with some of the slickest, sexiest dance moves ever out by a man in a lemon yellow cheetah and powder blue slacks. It's a bit startling, this convulsion of youthful exuberance from a man dressed like Paul out of ever-decreasing circles.
He tells us we've got a great show lined up and then spoilers half the acts on offer, telling us if we can handle that lot, then hopefully we can handle this. Can You Handle It? By Sharon Redd. Born in Norfolk, Virginia in 1945, Sharon Redd was the daughter of a producer at King Records, James Brown's original label. She signed to United Artists in 1968 and put out a few singles before being headhunted a year later by a couple of Australian stage producers who cast her in the Sydney production of Hair. She became an overnight success over there, appearing in adverts for Amoco petrol stations and landing her own TV special. But she, along with other black cast members, had their work visas unrenewed by the Australian Immigration Department, and she found herself back in America in the spring of 1971. A year later, she was recruited into Bette Midler's backing singers, the Harlettes, and stayed there for 6 years, during which time she and fellow Harlette Charlotte Crossley popped up on an episode of Rhoda as Johnny Ventura's backup. In 1978, she signed to RCA, and a year later, under the name Front Page, put out the disco single Love Insurance. And by 1980, she had moved to Prelude Records, the New York disco label, who had D-Train and Jocelyn Brown on their books. This is her first single release as a solo artist since her cover of Easy to Be Hard from the Hair soundtrack, which got to number 32 in the Australian chart in 1969. It entered the chart 3 weeks ago at number 60, then soared 17 places to number 43. And this week it's jumped 4 places to number 33, which has necessitated a big fly across the Atlantic for a Top of the Pops debut. And oh dear chaps, it's safe to say that this is the most disastrous welcoming party for an American since that episode of Dad's Army where Captain Mannering gets chinned twice. Fucking hell. Before we get into it, chaps, the first thing that needs to be pointed out is that immediately after introducing this, the camera sweeps across the studio floor. Powell, still in vision, breaks into a lumbering dad at a wedding dance. Oh, dear. He's not doing the running pal just yet, but he's more one of those, you know, them thumb toys or push puppets or whatever you call them. You know, when you've got a zebra or something and you push it underneath and it flops. Well, he's dancing like he's a push puppet and someone's just applied a tiny bit of pressure.
A flicker. By some distance, he's not the worst dancer.
No.
But what we see here in the studio, not only from Powell, but from the audience, is there's no other way of putting it apart from in a racist way.
Ooh.
It's the whitest dancing I have ever seen.
Should we talk about the single first? Should we get that out of the way?
Sure.
Because that'll take half a minute. Because it's a fucking tune, isn't it?
It's a great single, but what we're hearing here is not the single.
No. If you actually bought it as a single or heard it on the radio, you'd get a prime example of New York post-disco. You have to listen to the 12-inch special extended version, which is nearly 10 minutes long and fucking mint.
The recorded version is this crisp, kind of glittering. I mean, it's perfect. It's one of those early 80s funk tunes. Every single detail is perfect. What we have here is not that.
I mean, like most singles of its ilk and era, it would have completely sailed over my head at the time. You know, that combination of hardcore funk and show tune flamboyance. But the performance we get, fucking hellfire. It's as if Michael Hill's trying to prove a point by lumping together everything that he wants rid of from Top of the Pops.
I mean, I reiterate what we said earlier with regards to plenty of bits in this episode. If you'd have told me this was from 76, come on, it looks like 76. There seems to be this powerful idea in the 70s in particular that if you give a crowd of young people the task of sitting down and doing an annoying series of hand gestures to do, they'll be delighted. And like cattle, they'll join this herd of idiocy.
Yeah.
And this is what we get here. If we've just talked about the record, we now have to talk, I think, about how the Top of the Pops Orchestra play this record.
I thought this was all done by 1980.
No. The sound of Philadelphia cheese.
Indeed. I mean, it's a typically shonky start, right, before they actually settle into the song. There's a few bass mistakes and stuff. The use of the Top of the Pops Orchestra dates it, because, simply put, they never really got their heads around disco, did they? I mean, we keep saying disco, but what we hear is not disco.
No.
I mean, the point about disco, whether it's been made by Chic or whether it's made by AC/DC, who I think makes some great disco records, is that the kick drum is a regular thump throughout. And not to get too musicological, the kick drum, the bass drum, hits not just in between the snare hits, but on each snare hit. That's really key to disco. The Top of the Pops Orchestra, they play it with a normal sort of kick snare pattern, and it instantly dates the song.
Yes.
It dates the song back to the early 70s. As ever with the TATP orchestra, you know, it can't help but have that we've had a Watney's Party 7 each in the green room feel to it as well, you know. So,
or it'd be Arctic Light by now.
Yeah.
Or Breaker.
It's a shonky start, but they make it into a soul/funk record, not a disco record. So it's weird what we're hearing.
The big question here, I can't work out what she's singing into.
Right.
Because she's not holding a mic. She doesn't appear to have one clipped to that weird bodysuit that she's wearing. And I've never quite seen this before on Top of the Pops. Wherever the microphone is, it's too far from her mouth, because the acoustics of the vocal are horrendous. So I can't tell. Is she singing into like a boom mic off screen, like what they would use to record dialogue on a sitcom?
Maybe.
Surely not.
Do you reckon it was a hastily done sort of pre-recorded version that she did with the Top of the Pops Orchestra or
something? I thought of that.
Yeah.
I thought of that, but I don't think so. And I'll tell you why, because obviously it's not the record.
It's certainly not the record.
The record being a perfectly weighted production that sounds like a helicopter shot of some skyscrapers. As opposed to this two-on-the-floor nonsense. So I was looking for any suggestion that it was that and that she'd recorded the vocal earlier while not dancing. But in fact, not only does it look like she's singing live while dancing, it fucking sounds like it too. because every time she bends off in one direction, the level drops.
Right, right, right.
So it's very confusing. This clip is up on YouTube, but it's got the record dubbed over it.
Of course.
Unsurprisingly. But at least you can say that the audio fits the chaos of the scene.
Oh, God.
With all these kids rowing the boat like they're in school assembly. It's like you might as well have had girls tying plaits into the hair of the girl in front as Sharon Redd sings about how she's apparently so good in bed, it's intimidating.
Yes. I mean, the kids are all sat round on an elongated platform and they're doing a fucking group Blockbusters hand jive years before it was such a thing, man.
Yeah.
It's a appalling.
It is appalling. There's this particular young lady who I don't want to pick on, but she does look like she could be in her mid-60s, to be honest with you. But she's doing it so stiffly and so confusedly and bewilderedly, you know, because there's finger points involved in this thing that they're getting the kids to do. And the points she does are so fatally just not right on the beat. I mean, it's interesting watching any group of British dancers, to be honest with you, ever, because you can see the people who actually do dance to music. They've sort of just got it in their shoulders and their groove, you know? But some people are just incapable. I don't know how they live. And there's plenty of those in the audience here. It should be mentioned that a small modicum of dadisfaction is provided by Legs & Co. in the background.
Yeah, Legs & Co. are there as well.
I mean, they are still doing... They're doing that rubbish, I've just trod in dog shit move.
Yes. They're in the Doric chitons again, looking like they're doing a keep fit demonstration before some Christians get fed to the lion.
And also, like, Legs & Co. nearing the end of their working life.
Yeah.
Quite literally left on the shelf here.
Oh, yes.
For the first time in their lives. Relegated to this distant bookcase thing. And then a bit later in the song, they're let down from the shelf, but they're still not allowed out of their technical area. They've got a little painted off bit in the corner, and still having to wear industrial knickers in defiance of this obsessively upskirting cameraman. Like, why else are they on a raised platform? It must have got tiresome even for game girls like Legs & Co. In fact, this here is the last ever appearance of Pauline Peters, who left the Legs this week to be replaced for the final 6 months by Anita Chelimar, the Doug Yule of fixed grin hoofing. Actually, no, it's more like when Ron Wood joined The Creation, because that was also for a very brief period right at the end, and because they're both better known for what they did afterwards. Right. In Ron's case, The Faces and The Rolling Stones, and in Anita's case, Toto Coelho.
Oh, yes.
She Ate Cannibals.
Yes.
It was incredible. And as a founding member of the Toto Coelho Ultras, I am the bloke holding the megaphone with his back to the performance. I won't have anything bad said about it.
By this time, Legs & Co. are pulling double shifts almost every week, you know, doing their own routine and backing up some band. And I always assumed that it was because, you know, Michael Hurl wanted to jack up the dadisfaction. But now I think, were their contracts on a performance basis and Hurl wants them gone as soon as possible?
So he's just squeezing maximum value out of them before they're off.
Well, instead of saying you signed up for 52 weeks, you signed up to 52 performances. So we get you in two at a time and knob you off early.
Yeah. Also, lest we forget, providing a visual contrast to Two Man Sound.
Of course, yes. Serves neither party. You know, Legs & Co. are being pushed off to the side, and, you know, no one puts Legs & Co. in the corner. And meanwhile, Sharon Redd, she's there slinking about, telling everyone she's just the best shag ever. And she's doing it while standing next to lots of younger women.
Yeah, there is that.
In shorter skirts.
But to be fair, I think Sharon is the star here. Not just because it's her record. I think she looks great, and she's got this great sort of black spangly dress on. She moves great. Her performance background that you mentioned, you know, being in hair and things like that, is clearly there. And she puts it across, I mean, with this lumbering, fuck-awful arrangement, which has its pleasures, don't get me wrong. Like all Top of the Pops orchestra stuff, it has its interesting, slightly beard-up pleasures. But, she comes through it okay. The audience do not.
No.
It's a great opportunity for us to see the youth of 1981 and are fucking out.
Yeah.
Dear me. They're dressed so appallingly that if he had had the time, Steve Strange would be standing in their own front doorways and refusing them entrance to the outside world. No, sorry, this is not for you.
There's a couple of little punkers, though, in there, isn't there? There's a few dotted about, and they're actually some of the best dancers, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
The punks that are dotted in this audience, they provide some nice sort of moodiness later on in this episode as well. But yeah, is there anything more dispiriting than seeing British children forced into the blockbuster fucking dance?
It's well Cheggers plays pop, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they should have just given them an inflatable to jump up and down on.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, nobody's going to look cool doing that school assembly.
No.
But, I mean,
no.
Rarely has Top of the Pops felt more like a church hall dance and sausage sizzle, which at heart is what it always wanted to be, complete with stranger danger, but without the sausages, which were the best bit. You know when you watch these old Top of the Pops is on a downloaded file, and it's straight from the BBC VT. So sometimes at the end, they run on past where the TV broadcaster would have cut it. So after the credits, you get the whole of the closing song with the audience dancing. And then at the end, when it stops, you hear the floor manager barking at the kids to leave the studio. And it really does slice through the jollity like an oxyacetylene torch. Like you're supposed to be at the greatest party in the world, and then the second the music stops, some old bloke's bellowing like, "Thank you for coming. Now please leave the studio instantly." And it's a bit of a jolt, you know.
Yeah.
But ladies and gentlemen, you now have 9 seconds to vacate the building before we uncage the hyenas. They will be laughing. You will not. Good luck, children. This clip has got that same atmosphere, but while the fucking show is going on.
Yeah.
What needs to change, and I think Hurl realises it pretty soon, is that this thing of piling the stage with the kids, that's got to change for a fucking start off. I mean, if you're going to rebuild a set and make it like a nightclub, put the kids out in the nightclub, put zoo cunts up on the platforms, and just don't let shit like this happen again. Because even though the record itself, even in this iteration, is not a bad start to the show, the staging of it's pretty awful. Shaman does come through okay, though.
Apologies for repeating myself, Pop Craze Youngsters, but when we covered Department S in our live show last year, I quoted their interview in Smash Hits in May of this year when they were on Top of the Pops, and I'm quoting it again. 7 o'clock on a Wednesday evening, and in Studio 3 at the Television Centre, 100 teenagers are milling about beneath the white arc lights of Top of the Pops. Flick Colbert, the American choreographer of Legs & Co., gets up on stage to tell them what comes next and how to dance to it. The next one's by Department S, and that's a real Blitzkid number. I want some intense, meaningful movements. None of this silly disco stuff. So, by this time, Flick Colby's telling the kids what to do and telling them they've got to pay in sweat right now. Because by this point, Hull has clearly had enough with the kids just standing there or chatting to the mates about lads and shoes and what they like the look of in Chelsea Girl at the moment, or making rabbit ears behind the mates' back while Dean Freeman's trying to emote and has enlisted Sergeant Major Colbert. And by the look of this, it's an experiment that's doomed to failure and zoo are imminent.
Yeah.
Those kids here, you can see, are just ashamed of this enforced jollity and they just don't want any part of it.
The most shocking thing to my mind is the return of the Top of the Pops Orchestra and whatever the Maggie Stredder singers are calling themselves these days. And, you know, it's clear from the first note that they can't handle it. This might do for Seaside Special or the Yorkshire TV Disco Dancing Championship, but, you know, Sharon's been poorly served here.
Yeah.
She has.
If I wanted to go on Get It Together, I'd have gone on Get It Together.
Or
Wheel Tappers and Shunters or something.
Oh, can you imagine? So the following week, Can You Handle It nudged up 2 places to number 31 somehow and got no further. The follow-up, Love Is Gonna Get You, failed to chart, but she roared back in 1982 with Never Give You Up, getting to number 20 in November of that year. 10 years later, DNA, the Tom's Diner remix hit makers, collaborated with Red on an update of Can You Handle It, which got to number 17 in February of 1992, sparking what should have been a comeback, but she died of pneumonia 3 months later, at the age of 46.
Applause, our audience, Legs and Co, and Sharon Redd and Can You Handle It on Top of the Pops. OK, he's got an album coming out of the same name as the hit single. His name, Shaky Stevens, and This Old House.
This old house wants new children. This old house wants new wife.
How? After listing everyone responsible for the last performance, lies to the kids about a new LP that has actually been out for months, before throwing us into This Old House by Shaking Stevens. Yes, he added a G. Disgusting behaviour. Simon Bates wouldn't do that. Simon Bates knows when to snip off a G. Born in Evansville, Texas, in 1908, Carl Hamblin was the son of a preacher man who founded the Evangelical Methodist Church. In 1931, he relocated to California and became the host of the radio show Family Album, whilst nurturing a career as a country singer-songwriter. And in 1934, he became the first artist signed up to the American subsidiary of Decca. He rapidly became the most popular radio personality in Los Angeles, but the fame got to him, and he became a rabid pisshead and gambler. But in 1949, he turned up at a Billy Graham crusade in LA, an event which Graham later claimed was a turning point in his own popularity and bank balance. But when Hamblin subsequently tried to ban beer adverts off his radio show, he got the sack. In 1954, according to legend, Hamblin was on a hunting expedition with his mate John Wayne when they came across a dilapidated hut in the mountains which contained one mangy dog and a human corpse, which inspired him to write this song, which got to number 2 in the Billboard Country Chart. Later that year, it was covered by Rosemary Clooney and put out as a B-side to Hey There, which got to number 1 in America. But when it was released over here, the sides were flipped around and This Old House became her first UK number 1 in December of 1954. The song lay mouldering for a quarter of a century until it was recorded by the Kentucky band NRBQ, who recorded it rockabilly style for their 1979 LP Kick Me Hard, and it's this version that has been covered by the ever-victorious, iron-willed, highest incarnation of the revolutionary comradeship of heterosexual rock and roll. It's the follow-up to Shooting Gallery, which only got to number 46 in October of 1980, and is the third cut from his third LP, Marie Marie, which came out 5 months ago. It entered the chart at number 64 3 weeks ago, then soared 35 places to number 29. He was immediately invited into the Top of the Pop studio, which helped it soar another 22 places to number 7. This week it's jumped another 5 places and stands at number 2 in the chart. And here's a special filmed broadcast from Overway Cottage, a dilapidated coach house in Naunton Park near Bury St Edmunds, so Shaky can elaborate on his 5-year plan to address the social housing crisis. Yeah, Powell fucked up there when he said it was from an album that was coming out, because Epic have retitled Marie Marie to This Old House in the wake of this becoming a hit.
Right, right. Yeah. You know what? I don't think I've ever... Have I ever talked about Shaky before on Chart Music? I'm not entirely sure I have, which is remarkable, really.
That is.
Yeah.
Because for the rest of us, it's got to the point now where every time he comes on, it's like your brother-in-law's drop round without texting first. Like, oh, hello. It's like an easy familiarity, but without a great deal of affection. And yet, if you saw him in trouble in the street, you'd feel duty-bound to help out.
Yeah.
Not that Shaky would ever find himself in trouble in the street.
No, but he was everywhere in my life in 81. I think this video was probably my biggest first memory of Shaky. And I think the start of my liking of him, he's got that insanely good-looking dad Dave Bartram look. He's even better looking. And that jet black coiffeur is all important. But in 81, he's everywhere, you know? I mean,
yes,
he's on Des O'Connor. He's on Cannon and Ball, on Swap Shop. I mean, two of my most serpentine memories of him is that he's on Jim Will Fix It.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Two appearances really stuck in my head. I mean, there may well be more of them, but the two ones that really stuck in my head, there was one where two kids just write in and they want to dance with him, basically, and that's it. Jim, can you fix it? So they dance with him doing this old house, and, you know, the jingle noncer tells the little girl that she's very pretty and the little boy that he's a great mover. It's a bit grisly, but there's a bizarre faint memory I have that perhaps a pop craze youngster can confirm or find. Where a girl, she wanted to stay in a posh boarding school for the night. That was her wish, right? So she goes, she does the kind of posh boarding school stuff. They have a school disco to Japanese Boy, actually.
Right.
But then later on, there's this really bizarre moment where all the girls are in the dorm, you know, waiting for lights out. And Shaky just turns up to kind of check if they're all okay.
No, you dream that, Neil, surely.
No, I swear down, I have not dreamt that. Shaky just turns up, he turns up in the dorm, he checks they're all okay. He doesn't tuck him in or anything, but they're all sort of very excited to see him.
Shaky of the dorm, man. It sounds like a stripping gin tea or something.
But yeah, I mean, it's appearances like that that obviously by 81 turned him into a household name, given him the commercial momentum to make this a big hit. After quite a long journey, obviously, you know. He's been doing rock and roll revivalism since the days of fucking Sha-na-na, really. He was the only other guy doing it.
He's Shay-nay-nay.
Indeed. But in the late 70s, you know, he's kind of cool. John Lydon, at the end of an interview at the height of the Sex Pistols fame, says he's off to see Shakin' Stevens that night.
Fuck.
In that late 70s period, Danny Baker at the time wanted to call a kind of punk versus rockabilly summit to diffuse tensions, and he wanted Shaky there, you know, as the sort of Boutros Stevens there. But I mean, all the TV appearances obviously make him way more mainstream, and he's hitting right this year. You know, you've got the Stray Cats in the charts. Even Alvin Stardust has a hit again this year. With the 10, you know, rockabilly revival in full swing, and he's the perfect idol, really, for the sort of under nines, you know. So, you know, yeah. I mean, if I was old enough in 81 to feel spiritually behind new pop, his presence, his kind of retrograde presence, probably would have angered me. But no, I loved him, and this song, as you point out, I mean, you know, now sort of at our age, everything we watch or hear sounds like death, you know, even a Centre Parts advert. But I mean, this is a kind of song about death, and it's quite macabre in a way. But as an 8-year-old kid, I just thought he had a bit of a knackered house and he needs to fix it up.
This is the first opportunity we've had to actually look at a Shaking Stevens video,
right?
Which was the second one he ever made after Marie Marie. And, you know, by 1981, chaps, the promo video seen as an opportunity for an artist to expand upon their creative manifesto and harness the elements of multimedia to round out their artistic statement. So what does Shaky do here?
He sings it in front of an old owl.
Yeah, he starts with him leaping from the veranda over a camera, giving the audience a tantalizing denim upskirt shot, and then there's a bit of panther-like jiggling about in front of this dilapidator's house until he seizes the means of production and drives the axe of revolutionary socialism into the rotten stump of capitalism. Thwack!
They really missed a trick, though. They should have stayed true to the spirit of this song and put a corpse inside the old house.
Yeah.
And his dog still stood there guarding the door. Bloke dressed up as John Wayne.
And then eating his face at the end of it.
Yeah. Mm. The terrible thing about that story is the fact that the dog was still alive.
Yeah.
Suggests that the bloke only died recently, which in a way is more creepy than if he'd been there 2 years. It's like, you know, when you're going down a B road in the country somewhere and you see an overturned car in the ditch and you just assume it's been left abandoned there for days. When in fact, for all you know, it could have gone off the road 90 seconds ago, just before you came around the corner, and the wheels might only just have stopped spinning. But yeah, they don't do it. They don't do it. There's a corpse in an armchair and a starving dog behind the green door.
No, instead, his mates turn up, don't they?
There's like a Brotherhood of Man foursome who've just walked out of a Kay's catalogue. And it cuts back to Shaky giving him a lean and hungry look while still clapping, of course. And, you know, to my mind, the video starts to take on sinister, video nasty-like connotations.
Yes.
This surly youth brandishing an axe and four people come walking along all happy and couplet. It never ends well, does it?
No, and it looks like a video nasty as well.
Yes, it does.
Because of the strange way it's lit.
Yeah.
Because it's not shot on video, it's shot on 16mm film, which is less forgiving in gloomy conditions. So on some of these shots, there's an eerie glow with a very dark shadows behind, because it was obviously such a miserable day that by the time they were filming Shaky posing upstairs in the old house by the window pane, he says he's not going to mend. There wasn't enough light, so they've had to turn a big arc light on him, and it creates that slightly unearthly post-apocalyptic look. But it's cheap lighting, so it gives it the feel of a very low-budget horror film.
Yeah.
Halloween.
Blood on white shoes.
Also aggravated by the fact that these days all the copies of Top of the Pops in circulation come from these supposed restorations done by a private citizen, which look like they've just gone through one of those free Photoshop filters, because you can't restore or upscale Top of the Pops to HD because they were made on videotape, which is a standard definition medium. And even stuff shot on film like this has been telecinned onto video. So there is no HD information. That is, it's not there at source. So the confused computer just smooths everything out as best it can, and it just sharpens the edges and flattens the shadows, and you end up with all the detail wiped out.
Yeah.
And it destroys the image that's there. Especially small areas of detail, like people's faces, to the point of it being disturbing. So when Shaky's catalogue model friends come down the path to join his fun at the old house, it looks like Silent Hill on the PS1. You look at a screenshot of their faces, or the concave caverns of Lovecraftian horror where their faces were. It's fucking horrible.
Yeah.
But it's also an interesting lesson in photogenia, because these ordinary looking extras who were all sort of blandly pleasant looking, you put them through the faux upscaling process, they come out looking like abattoir sweepings. Whereas Shaky's own face has been subjected to the same process of simplification and approximation. And when you wipe all the detail out of his face, he just ends up looking even more like his own Viz cartoon.
Yes.
He looks great. Maybe in the same way that the secret of a memorable and distinctive animated character is that they should be instantly recognisable in silhouette, maybe the secret of being a late 20th century pop icon is having the kind of face that becomes stronger and more distinctive the more degraded and messy the image becomes with the passing of time over generations of cheap reproduction. And this is why 40 years on, everyone's still talking about Shaking Stevens. Not that you'd ever associate Shaking Stevens with the words cheap reproduction, you understand.
The thing is, that sinister thing you identified in the video sort of tipped me the wink as a kid that, yeah, this song's perhaps not about just fixing up an old house. But there was always something sinister about Shaky, and I think that was part of his appeal. And I don't mean sinister in a bad way.
Who's he going to spring upon next?
Well, there's that.
He's already taken down Maidler. It could be you.
But you never got the feeling that, you know, it, no matter what chaff he was on, like if he was on Cheggers Plays Pop or something, you didn't think, oh yeah, Shaky's going to go off and hobnob with Cheggers now. No. Cheggers is going to go and do whatever he's doing, which probably, you know, is is completely innocent and full of bonhomie.
The pub.
Shaken Stevens, who knew what home he was going back to? Mm. he had this sort of mystery to him. And consequently, yeah, I mean, this song, it is a song about death. And of course, as a kid, you don't quite get that. The black door of death doesn't loom large in your consciousness at that age because it just seems so far away. Mm. The lyrics confuse me a little bit. You know, growing up in an old people's home, the line about not having time to fix the shingles really medically confused me. but overwhelmingly, as a kid, this was just a simple, fun song to sing and dance to. And the jauntiness of the arrangement, of course, helps that.
Yeah.
But so did this video. I didn't quite pick up the sinister overtones at the time. Now, watching it, I can't believe I didn't, because it is an unsettling watch.
So after the axe bit, there's a series of cuts where he points at things that are in the song. So, you know, thanks to Shaky, I found out what a shingle was long before I should have done. And then he leaps from the top window to the ground, ready to stalk his prey, who we later see trapped in the attic, being forced to sing out the window, presumably in a vain cry for help. And then Shaky finds a baseball on the floor, and I did look at it hard. And it is a baseball.
It's too odd for it not to have just been there. And they thought, hey, that's great. Let's use it. It's American.
Yeah, hey, Shaky, you like American stuff.
Who's got a baseball in Bury St. Edmunds? You know, a baseball bat possibly, but not a ball.
Mm.
And then he picks the baseball up and he tosses it from hand to hand. And then he turns around and just lobs it skyward.
Yeah, fucking hooligan.
Shaking Stevens has thrown a baseball over a house. What have you done?
Someone's greenhouse paying the price for that.
Mm. Mm. There's a happy ending of sorts, because the Brotherhood of Man types are let out into the front yard and they instantly transmogrify into 13 people, including a child, which leads me as a viewer to believe that Shaken Stevens is actually the leader of a cult who have taken up squatters' rights in the countryside, which is, you know, which is nice. No one's died yet. But yeah, going back to the song, Neil, because the original version by Stuart Hamblin, it is your bog standard religious ramble, you know, doesn't matter if you're poor and your living arrangements are killing you because, you know, Jesus has prepared a new build with all mod cons in heaven for you.
Yeah, yeah.
But like all good benevolent dictators, the Man of Denim, as we know him as, has painted all that bollocks out of the picture, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's partly because he delivers the songs in an extremely mushed mouth manner, like he was eating a sausage cob. But he also alters the lyric in the chorus, you know, because Stuart Hamblin says, I'm a getting ready to meet the saints.
Yeah, yeah.
Rosemary Clooney sang, he's a getting ready to meet the saints. But Comrade Shaker, he sings, she's a getting ready to meet the saints, which implies that it's a house that's going to die and ascend to the Barrett estate in the sky.
Or he's taking his daughter to a meet and greet at Southampton Football Club.
Yeah, because like you, Neil, I just thought Shaker's going, oh, I'm Shaken Stevens, this house is shit. Yeah. I'm going to buy a new one.
That's it.
Denim house.
Yeah, it's had its day. It's had a good innings. Let's move on and get on the property ladder is my kind of overwhelming message from the song.
Yeah.
Or a meet and greet at the tour of the This Perfect Day Hitmakers. Right, is it hack to say this? Right, I don't know. But to me, it's perfect that whatever this song's actually about, it's perfect that the man who took these lyrics to number one went on to be a landlord.
Mm.
Now, he should absolutely have had this as the voicemail on whichever number he gave to his tenant. And just left his phone permanently switched off, so he's impossible to contact. He just goes, ain't got time to fix this.
Like all fucking landlords.
Yeah, it would just like a normal landlord, but more musical. Except that in this case, he ain't got time to fix the shingles or the floor or the boiler because he's getting ready to meet the saints rather than because he's getting ready to go to Alicante for 3 weeks again.
So why is Shaken Stevens so popular in 1981? 1981 of all years.
Well, look, two things I think, right? He's massively good looking. Two, and I'm perhaps I'm overestimating this, but I also detect this in a later record. The power of the Grease soundtrack should never be underestimated. Things that sound 50s-ish but have a modern production are going to hit big.
Yeah, because
it's just lodged in people's consciousness so much. So yeah, I think that might have something to do with it.
Mm.
Plus, he's ubiquitous. He is fucking everywhere. He's appearing on everything. So it's difficult to avoid him.
He's generation straddling, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
I think the only people who sort of hated Shaken Stevens at this point were fierce poptimist advocates of new pop who probably would have seen this as shamelessly retrograde and worthless.
Mm.
But for the rest of us, yeah, it's just a fun record with a very good-looking man singing it.
He was ubiquitous. He was the subject of one of Ronnie Corbett's best jokes, of course.
Oh.
Ronnie Corbett was talking about something that had scared him, and he said, "I haven't been so nervous since I stood next to Shakin' Stevens in The Gents." Which, if you don't get that joke, what it's saying is, he's suggesting the image of Ronnie Corbett being showered with urine as an uncontrollably gyrating Welshman pissing like a horse insists on standing right next to him at the urinal, despite the fact that, like an unmanned garden hose, his penis is flapping around everywhere because of the shaking, and he's sousing the pint-sized discursive storyteller in gallon after gallon of 50s revivalist piss, and Ronnie's just standing there with waves of piss dripping down the lenses of those iconic black frame glasses, like the windscreen of a Mercedes in a car wash, or the rainy windows of a Glaswegian tenement in his Scottish homeland, wringing out his Lyle and Scott V-neck into the sink, you know. What? Imagine if it all went in his mouth and all that.
Oh, gross.
I should say, by the way, I did go and check that joke before I quoted it to make sure I got the wording right, because like all writers or people who call themselves writers, I know there's nothing worse than someone quoting your work, especially the jokes, and getting it just slightly wrong after you spent a very long time getting it precisely right. Such is the insatiable perfectionism of the creative genius. You know, Oscar Wilde was once supposedly asked, "Oscar, what did you do this morning?" And he said, "I removed a semicolon from one of my poems." And they said, "How did you spend the afternoon?" And he said, "Putting it back in again." No. This is what it's like. We wouldn't know anything about this stuff, of course, but I guarantee you that whoever wrote that joke for Ronnie Corbett will have laid in bed tossing and turning, flipping that sentence backwards and forwards in their mind for hours, looking for the perfect structure, really earning their three-piece suite and cocktail cabinet. And this is why comedy writers are paid such outrageous sums of money, because you get the rhythm of the sentence wrong and you lose the gag. Everything rests on linguistic precision. It's like a surgeon, your mirth in their hands. Just one slip and you've got a pancreas hitting the floor with a wet slap. It's terrible. Can you imagine the repercussions if Eddie Large had ever told a joke that wasn't funny?
Yeah.
That would have been that. Career over. We've had to go back to living off Sid Little's dinner money.
And it needs saying, by the way, this old house, right, I think this is best shaky. This is best shaky for me.
Mm.
It's his best one.
Right.
Not that I'm going to sit around listening to it, but in terms of getting those jitters in your legs when you're 8 years old, this is the one.
Oh, I think this was the single that just turned me squarely against Shaker.
Right.
I removed myself from all that Ted shit, and here it was again.
Yeah.
I mean, when it got to number one, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, but your age difference, Al, that's the thing. You were sick of him by now.
Complete age difference, because while I was watching Top of the Pops, if I was allowed to watch it in the living room, this would come on and my dad would be like, "Oh, fucking hell, yeah, finally. Finally something good," and the knees would start going and everything. Yeah. And it was like, oh, God.
Yeah, I can imagine it's not sitting well with a young mod.
Yeah.
No.
It's rocker shit, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
And in No Escape either. You know, I mentioned earlier that episode of Summertime Special I watched. And Shakey's on that,
of
right?
Course. Mm.
And it's genuinely fascinating because, for a start, he's introduced by Rod Hull and Emu, but alas, from a safe distance.
Yeah.
So
we don't get to see what would have become the featherweight title bout of early 80s light entertainment. But also, because Shakey performs a live version of This Old House.
Oh, yes, I've heard that.
The Summertime Special Band, yeah, who make the Top of the Pops orchestra sound like Booker T and the MGs.
Yes, they do.
And he's got the most unnaturally twinkly eyes I've ever seen, and he doesn't seem to be able to remember the words very well.
Yes!
Now, admittedly, This Old House does have three verses, but he's been singing it all year every day, over and over again. And yet there's moments where he just seems to be doing what you do when you're walking around your flat singing a song out loud.
Yeah.
And you can't quite remember how it goes, so you just make some noises with your mouth that are similar phonetically. Like the greatest ever example of this being Jimi Hendrix's version of All Along the Watchtower.
Yeah.
Which is a track I listen to quite a lot, because in East London there's always a low-flying police helicopter overhead. The only way to make that noise sound good is to put on All Along the Watchtower and pretend you're in the NAM. But he seemingly recorded that song without knowing the words.
West NAM.
Yeah, which when you're doing a Dylan cover, is bordering on mischief. But you can hear him. He goes, none will ever on the mine. Nobody of it is worth. It's just gibberish. But on that record, by the first guitar break, nobody cares, right? But when it's shaky, smouldering into the camera, and he's going, all right, I mean, I'm all for ad libs, right? But I think with this song, you're honour bound to stick to the text, lest you spoil that mood of John Wayne in a bothy staring at a corpse in an armchair and a starving dog. Because that's what the kids want, right?
Yeah.
John Wayne, big leggy himself.
Indeed.
Got off his horse, drank his milk, looked deep into his horse's eyes. Well, no, he could only see one of them, actually, because he was standing around the side. So he gazed into the deep black intelligence of that one eye, like a snooker ball embedded in a veiny blanket. And he turned to Stuart Hamblin and he said, "Stu, not only do I believe in white supremacy and the ostracization of gay men, but you know elephants, cute little baby elephants. I say fuck them. Fuck them up the trunk and drink your milk." And then spring arrived and they both went home. It was one of the defining moments. You might almost say iconic moments in rock and roll history. And without that history, this song is almost meaningless.
Yeah.
I mean, look, but the thing is with Shaky, what's crucial to me with Shaky in this period is he has the appeal of almost a cartoon, because he's impervious to analysis as a child. Mm. You don't look at Shaky and think, oh, I know the person behind that.
Yeah.
Or I know the background behind that. He's just fully formed, utterly impervious to analysis, never really revealing anything about himself in anything that I was exposed to. So he couldn't be demystified. Look, I'm not saying he's a bewitching kind of spellbinding figure. It's Shakin' Stevens we're talking about. But there was no sort of background to him. Do you know what I mean? I mean, not that I knew about as an 8-year-old. You just got the idea that, yeah, he was on all these TV shows, but that didn't demystify him, because you just got the feeling that afterwards he went on being Shakin' Stevens. He just walked around being Shakin' Stevens in his life. And you know, that's really important as a kid.
Jumping off things.
Exactly. Yeah. That's really important as a kid.
Just climbing up things and then jumping off them. It would take him half an hour to get to the shops. Because he'd have to jump on things and climb up them.
Pioneer of parkour.
But no, you're onto something, Neil, because, you know, out of all the mock and roll acts of the 70s and early 80s, Shake is the only one who plays it without the slightest trace of an element of humour. You know, Show Waddy Waddy never took themselves seriously, neither did Darts or Rocky Sharp and the Replays, or, you know, even Coast to Coast, who are currently at number 5, but sadly not in this episode. But no, Shaky, he's not joking, is
he? No, he takes his bubble with him, you know, everywhere he goes, and it never gets punctured, and that's really
the
appealing.
Mask never slips.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Grown more serious with age as well. Have you heard his new song?
No, I haven't. Yeah. I heard it's... Is it Ace?
No, it's called All You Need Is Greed. It's a condemnation of today's money focused culture, you know. Maybe nowadays the shaking is largely involuntary, but the social conscience is still glowing white hot, you know. It sounds like a Bryan Adams 12-inch extra track.
Right.
It's nice that he gives a fuck, I suppose. And what a thrill to be lectured on greed by a buy-to-let landlord.
Yes.
Invigorating.
Yeah, but it shows how he's not been forgotten, because there was a lot of excitement about that, yes. wasn't there? You know, about him coming back. Yeah. I've detected more excitement about the new Shakin' Stevens single than, like, I don't know, Susie and the Banshees going on the road. Mm. It's, you know, people are, oh, wow, yeah. he's yeah. back.
Wet leg, wet who? It's only one leg I'm interested in, and it's going...
And yes, Neil, it is only March, but, you know, there is going to be a whole lot of shaking going on in 1981, especially during what the kids are going to be calling the Summer of Shaker, because he's going to be the focal point of Let's Rock, which is Jack Good's latest attempt to do Old Boy Again, an 18-part series made by ATV in Birmingham for American television. It's already been out in America, and God knows how they reacted to it, but it'll launch on ITV in July on Saturday nights, featuring Shaker, Alvin Stardust, Joe Brown, Lulu, Den Hegarty, and all the original Ted singers that are still alive. Have you seen that?
I have. And you know what you were saying about
me.
You know what you were saying about not smirking? That's the thing. That's what marks Shaky is different, because a lot of people on that show, especially Joe Brown, smirks their way. Or it's fucking awful, that program, man.
Mm.
It's a headache, that show. It never stops. It starts... Yeah. And it's just a racket for about 20 minutes. And yeah, it's horrible.
Starts off with a racket, and then here comes some more racket with some other old bloke.
Yeah, yeah.
But Shaky Man, he puts himself about. There's one scene where I can't remember what the song was, because he didn't do his own songs on that.
No, no.
But there's one scene where he's doing his pieces, and he's in front of this enormous jukebox that's got a record player on the top.
Mm.
And you see Shaky going up this absolutely fucking massive ladder, you know, the type of ladder they use in a studio to change the lights, goes up to the top of there holding this massive cardboard record.
Yeah.
You just look at it and you just go, health and safety, anyone?
Yeah, yeah, but he doesn't give a fuck, man.
No, he doesn't.
It's about rock and roll.
Does he not jump off in slow motion?
No, sadly not. But the standout moment of that series, because there is a compilation of it on YouTube and in the video playlist, they have the Rocking Shades being joined by the cast and audience for a rousing version of the 1958 Jesse James song, South's Gonna Rise Again, complete with fucking Confederate flags aplenty.
Oh, God, man.
Including one massive one that comes down and obscures about half the audience. And the audience are brandishing pro-rockabilly banners in the same font as the ones that the kids used to hold up in Tiswas.
Oh, dear.
If Chris Tarrant organised a Ku Klux Klan rally, this is what it would look like.
Maybe it means South Wales.
Mm. Yeah. That clearly must have been a massive influence on Bobby Gillespie and Primal Scream.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else to say, chaps?
Yeah, I'm afraid.
Of course there is. It's Shaker.
Yeah. Neil, you know, you said you didn't really know anything about Shaking Stevens.
No, I don't.
I'll fill in some of that background, because I've recently been privileged to read this book, the intriguingly titled Shaking Stevens, which is a paperback biography published by Star Books, ever the mark of quality, in 1983, written by Paul Barrett, Shaky's former manager.
Ooh.
Paul Barrett. Shaking Goldman, with whom Shaky parted ways roughly around the exact moment he hit the big time. And it turns out...
Isn't he his brother as well?
It's not. It's the name spelt differently. It turns out he's exactly the right man to have written this book, because not only does he have access to all those early hardscrabble stories and insider tales from the Sunsets tour van, he was clearly a pivotal figure in Shaking Stevens' life, because we can see that while Shaky was being managed by Paul, he was a bit of a rough diamond, but essentially a nice, simple lad from South Wales who liked rock and roll, liked to drink, liked the ladies, wasn't above causing a bit of mischief from time to time. Mm. And then as soon as he split from Paul, he immediately turned into the world's biggest cunt. Now, that might just be a coincidence, but surely it's far more likely that Paul's steadying hand is what made the difference. And Shaky was led astray by his subsequent, much more high-powered and far more successful manager, who, if this book is to be believed, is also a complete bitch. Very sad what happened to him, I now understand. Now... you can gauge how carefully proofread this book was by the fact that in the course of its 150 pages, Paul misspells the names of Jimi Hendrix, the Savile Theatre, Hanoi, pedal steel guitar, Adrian Henry, That's All Right Mama by Arthur Big Boy Crudup, Arthur Big Boy Crudup, the town of Bastard in Sweden, willfully, I think, that one, Hound Dog, Espresso.
How do you misspell Hound Dog?
He didn't put a W in, did he?
No, he spelled it as one word, H-O-U-N-D-O-G.
Oh, no!
Yeah. Clark Kent, Muff Winwood, and so on and so on. I mean, there are some revelations in here, right? Like the fact that Shaky is actually a natural blonde.
No!
Oh, know that, did you? Yes, it's true. Or that his status as Comrade Shaky is really reflected commitment from Paul Barrett
and some of the Sunsets
who were proper commies and organised all those CPGB benefits. But what's most interesting are the little details, like how he wouldn't let his wife come to the pub with him, quote, as her more equality-minded contemporaries might have insisted upon. But sometimes he would take her out on a drive around local social clubs and leave her literally locked in the car.
Oh, no! What, with a bag of crisps and a bottle of Coke with a straw in it?
Yeah.
There's the travel mastermind. See you in a bit.
Yes. Him and Paul Barrett went in to organise gigs with the managers of the social clubs, and that's the only time she was allowed out of the house.
Jesus. You ain't going to leave this house no longer.
There's also that story that we've already covered on this podcast where they play Kenneth Tynan's daughter's birthday party. And Shaky cops off with a certain flame-haired Irish authoress and guest on the first ever episode of Question Time.
Now, fuck!
I wouldn't necessarily have this author down as a rock expert.
No.
Here's a passage from page 51. It was early November, brackets, 1969, when John Lennon appeared at a peace festival in Toronto, wearing a white drape suit and playing a couple of rock and roll numbers. It reached the ears of the rock fans in England as something of a joke. John Lennon had never before expressed a love for their music. Right. Okay. And I'm not 100% sure about his assessment that if the soul of Elvis flew anywhere after his death, it surely would have flown into the young Shakin' Stevens. Or even that Shakin' Stevens is. He exists as a phenomenon. However he got there is a matter for the academics to debate. He doesn't particularly care.
That's where we come in.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're too kind, Paul. But I love most the actual transitional moment on page 119, when Shaky has found success playing Elvis in the West End show, which was his big break. And suddenly, Paul, who has been narrating this story very sympathetically the whole time, always taking Shaky's side, suddenly becomes a third party being quoted by name in his own book.
Right.
And it's a neat postmodernist touch.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit jarring. It says, to Paul, that last gig with Shaky had been a huge relief. Quote, I waved goodbye to years of acting as nursemaid, nanny, pimp, and official nose wiper that night, he says.
God.
And after that, all bets are off, right? We're told about Shaky becoming a horrible spoilt man baby monster. We hear about Shaky having a piss against Marty Wilde's house.
No!
Yeah, while the young Kim Wilde is inside.
No!
Oh, yeah. Shaky being a complete prick about owing people money.
Oh.
Shaky moving into his new house and immediately sawing down all the ancient firs and elders in the garden because he didn't like trees.
And he killed some puppies whilst doing that, presumably.
Seriously. And best of all, the night that the boy playing young Elvis in the show.
Oh, yeah. Who was the host of Let's Rock? Let's remember.
Oh, yeah. Under the unlikely stage name GBH.
Yes.
Yeah. One night, he dropped out with illness and his understudy appeared instead.
Right.
And despite the nerves or whatever, the young lad did really well, was congratulated by everyone, and then received a summons to the star's dressing room, where Shaky, very drunk, started screaming at him, "Don't you ever do that again. You were imitating me out there." To which the lad pointed out that, in fact, he was imitating Elvis. And Shaky shouted at him, "Don't deny it. You were moving your legs like me. That's what I do." Before being physically held back as the child is bundled out of the dressing room. And then until finally, the last chapter of this book is just flat out bitching. Like, the water temperature has been slowly turned up and now suddenly we're being boiled alive. And the last few pages are like Paul Barrett's brain exploding. I'll read you the last paragraph of this book.
Right.
Ooh.
Shaky is constantly being quoted as having had a hard time of it on the way up the ladder to success. It wasn't all that hard, actually. Any sleeping in the van was done either on the way home or if it broke down, although Paul Barrett was affiliated to the efficient RAC for many years. Hotel rooms in Europe were of excellent standard. Paul insisted on it as part of any European deal. For a young boy who had left school at 15, semi-literate and without formal qualifications of any kind, life as the lead singer in a rock and roll band offered far more glamour and interest and wages than working as an upholsterer ever could. And yet, now that he's got his mansion in the country and his big cars, he feels angry at the world for making him wait so long for something he feels he deserved a long time ago. Hence the aggressive attitude to journalists. But there's a well-known saying in the entertainment business which goes something like, you should be nice to the people you meet on the way up because you're going to need them on the way down. If Shaky doesn't continue to defy gravity in his career and one day falls from popularity, he'll find it so much harder than most. To quote Paul Barrett, who has been watching Shaky's career with the caring, concerned interest of a colleague who has been a friend, he's got what he always wanted, but he's almost certainly lost what he had.
No.
And what he had, we now understand, was Paul Barrett.
Yes.
And that's a hell of a thing to lose.
So the following week, Comrade Shaker, after choosing his enemy, this week's number one, prepared his plans minutely and slaked an implacable vengeance upon them before going to bed satisfied upon the summit of Mount Pop for 3 weeks in a row, eventually being usurped by a single we're going to hear later on. It would finish the year as the fifth biggest selling single in 1981, one place below Prince Charming and one above Vienna. The follow-up, You Drive Me Crazy, spent 4 weeks at number two, held off the top spot by Stand and Deliver, but he went back to the rocking up an old tune bag for the follow-up to that and took Green Door to number one for 4 weeks in August. An overweight cottage still stands today after it was bought by a local architect and converted and refurbished, offering 2,150 square feet of well-proportioned living accommodation, an L-shaped reception room, a double-aspect sitting room with an open fireplace, four double bedrooms, and a double cart lodge, which went on the market in 2019 at nearly 700 grand.
Oof. I did some of the notes for this one in a cafe on Bethnal Green Road, and it says here in my notes, and I quote, "Two beautiful women in their early 20s at next table laughing, sat here on my own trying to think of something new to say about Shaking Stevens. Perhaps I should introduce myself. That might go well. Ask them if they can think of something new to say about Shaking Stevens. Help, what has happened? Sweet bird you are, quicker than a falling star." But it's a tough world. Nobody ever said it wasn't going to be a tough world.
And did you?
No, of course not.
Shaky Stevens, and This Old House is at number two.
And it's been some time since Colin Blunstone blessed the British TV scene. But he's together with Dave Stewart, who created his version of the Jimmy Ruffin classic. It's at 30, and what becomes of our broken-hearted?
Cutting back to Pal, we're immediately whipped into the future as we witness a pair of hands operating a bank of synthesizers. Pal tells us that it's been a long time since the next act blessed the British TV scene, making it sound like Danny LaRue's return from Vegas. But no, it's what becomes of our broken-hearted tut-tut-tut by Dave Stewart with Colin Blunstone. Born in Hatfield in 1945, Colin Blunstone was the son of an aeronautical engineer and a professional dancer who teamed up with Paul Atkinson, Hugh Grundet and Rod Argent to form the Zombies in 1961 while they were all at the St Albans County Grammar School for Boys. In 1964, after winning a beat combo Battle of the Bands competition sponsored by the London Evening News, they signed a deal with Decca, and their debut single, She's Not There, immediately smashed into the chart, spending 2 weeks at number 12 in September of that year. That would be their only top 40 hit in the UK, however, as they spent much of 1965 in America. And in 1967, they signed to CBS to record the LP Odyssey and Oracle, the lead-off cut of which, Time of the Season, got to number 3 over there in March of 1969, despite the fact that the band had split up in December of 1967, leading to not only one, but two bands to tour around America, pretending to be them, one of which featured Frank Beard and Dusty Hill before they formed ZZ Top. Blunstone had quit the music business after the Zombies split and had worked as an insurance clerk for a while, but the success of Time of the Season encouraged him to return as a solo artist, recording a new version of She's Not There under the name Neil MacArthur, which got to number 34 over here in the last week of 1969. In 1971, he signed to Epic and put out his debut solo LP One Year, and the lead-off single, Say You Don't Mind, got to number 15 in March of 1972. The follow-up, I Don't Believe in Miracles, got to number 31, but when his next single and the next two LPs flopped, he moved to Rocket Records, putting out three more LPs that were only released in Europe. This year, however, he's teamed up with Dave Stewart, the former keyboard player of Egg, Hatfield and the North and Bruford, but not the Eurythmics, for a cover of the Jimmy Ruffin single, which got to number 8 in January of 1967 and number 4 in August of 1974. It entered the chart last week at number 57, and this week it soared 27 places to number 30. And here they are in the studio. First question, chaps, would you have known anything about the Zombies at the time?
At the time, no, not in 81, no.
No. I'm a bit older than you, so I would have heard She's Not There, but more likely the Santana version in 1977 or the UK subs one in 1979.
Is this before or after that advert that went, let me tell you, that is Goose's Cook?
Ooh.
Memorable, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was the first time I heard She's Not There. I remember hearing this advert thinking, this is a great tune.
Yeah. Mm.
And like my mum or dad going, no, it's an old song.
Yeah. What was that for?
I remember that about as well as you remember the advert.
Oh, well.
Some office shit.
Well, it's weird, isn't it? Because we've just had Shaky doing an old song, and I'd have been delighted about that, and I'd have been so angry about this
right.
as an eight-year-old. Mm. You know what? It actually makes me angry now.
Really?
More angry.
To the chart music. But, well, in a way, there's too many oddities here in a sort of pop cultural history sense in my head to deal with. What we have here, we have essentially a sort of prog rocker, in a way, from Hatfield in the North, backing a 60s psych pop singer, playing a vintage Motown song electronically while wearing a Pill t-shirt.
Mm.
I mean, I think the key word here is bank raid, basically. This will be a hit among oldies and perhaps for a few youngies who like their sin.
It's tainted love for dads, isn't it, this?
Yeah. But, you know, whereas Tainted Love, the thing is, you know, the differences in the soft cell version of Tainted Love to the original are delightful. The differences with the original here are really key. Mm. Blundstone, I mean, he has got one of the clearest, most liquid voices in British pop.
Mm.
It's a great voice he's got.
Yes, he has.
So that means in this version, you know, there's no oomph or grit here like the Jimmy Ruffin version.
Yeah, and he's not clapping with massive gold bangles on and eyeliner.
He's not. But that suits Stewart's arrangement, which occasionally breaks off into these sort of odd passages of nothingness. The song happens, but in between, there's like these demo of the presets on his keyboard, basically, a journey around his Ace keyboard. So this would have angered me. This would have angered me as much as the sort of spike punk in the front row of the audience, who clearly didn't have to stand there.
No.
But just decides to go stand there and look totally disgusted with the whole thing. It is dad synth. It's one of those songs. I mean,
dad synth is a genre to conjure with, isn't it?
It is. It is.
God, but what else is going to be in that?
Well, things like Jean-Michel Jarre and things, you know.
It's My Party by Doja Cat and Barbara Gaskin.
Of course. I think the kids would have known of the original.
I did at the time. I mean, we've mentioned on Chart Music before that this is one of the greatest songs ever when it was done by Jimmy Ruffin.
Mm.
I knew of it by the time this came out and I didn't approve.
Look, Blundstone's got a lovely voice.
Mm.
It's a well-appointed, well-tooled voice, but it's not the right song for him, I don't think. You want a bit of grit with this song. It's about having a broken heart. So,
yeah,
you know, that's lacking. And what Stewart fills things out with is all a bit proggy. It's a bit pre-Howard Jonesy. It's not pleasant.
Mm.
I'm honestly not sure who's the worst Dave Stewart. This one, the one from the Eurythmics, or the one who fucked my cousin's hamster to death.
Easily done.
Yeah, well, I certainly trust you on that. This sideline of taking old songs and doing them in a self-consciously modern style, you know, like a more basic BEF.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I didn't like it then, and I don't like the modern equivalent, which is ukulele Trustafarian time, you know, or some indie band doing, hey, listen, this is a pop hit, but we're playing it as though it were real music, i.e. worse. And it's tired to complain about that stuff. But the point is, we're still getting that kind of stuff, even now, when complaining about it has become old hat.
Yeah.
Never mind the stuff itself. So at this point, it's a bit like being an evolutionary biologist and meeting a fundamentalist Christian who says, ah, you believe that one day a fish just turned into a monkey. It's like you spent 35 years developing your understanding of the most arcane intricacies of your speciality, and then suddenly you realise the power is with people who aren't just totally ignorant, they're frighteningly ignorant, and they're looking down their nose at you, and they're in charge. You know what I mean? It's like we're sitting at home splitting the pop cultural atom in between counting out two pence pieces and scrubbing mold off the shower, and these cunts are basically banging two rocks together and grunting, and they've just taken delivery of a new Ferrari Monza. You know, cunts. Well, I say good luck to him.
Colin, he looks very Mr. Lucas in his shiny powder blue suit at first, as he's obscured by the spiky hair of that punk youth. But
that's the best bit, because, it's the camera trying to swing around the conker shell hair of a 1981 punk, because his spikes are obscuring Colin Blunston's face, or rather the underside of Colin Blunston's face, because it's the usual Top of the Pops camera angle, so it looks like you're giving him a fucking blowjob. But it's possibly the most authentic image of bog standard 1981, right? As opposed to the curated modern memory version.
Yeah.
It's a 60s relic in a sports jacket grinding out a last few grand, semi-obscured by an 18-year-old who's 4 years out of date.
Yeah.
There was a lot of this.
Yeah. What would that lad think of Dave Stewart wearing a pill t-shirt, eh?
Maybe when they were coming on stage before the floor, you know, when the floor manager got them on stage, the punk saw that t-shirt and thought, ooh, and went and had a look. But
get up the front.
Exactly. He looks bitterly disappointed. Mm. I mean, they're both being retrograde, obviously, because like Taylor says, this guy's 4 years out of date, this spiky conk punk. He literally looks like, yeah, one of those ones who was posing for Japanese tourists for a quid a pop in 1978, you know, when it was all over. But it's grimness. It's and you know, it's weird because, you know, I was having lots of fun listening to Shaky literally 30 seconds ago.
No,
and then here's
Neil.
Another old song. And I'm hating every minute of it as an 8-year-old, most certainly.
Is that because you could associate yourself more with old houses than you could with broken hearts?
It's simple at that age, isn't it? It's just, it's just, this has got to beat, this hasn't, fuck this.
Yeah.
You know.
But when the camera pulls back and we see Mr. Lucas in his full pomp, hang on a minute. He's actually come dressed as Shakin' Stevens, hasn't he? He's got the collars turned up and he's even got white fucking shoes on. God, just as well it was only a Shakin' Stevens video this week, or Colin Blunstone would be summoned up to a dressing room at the end of the show for a, for a dressing down.
It's a neat preview of just how dull synthesizers can be as well. I mean, you know, there was an awful lot of synth excitement in this period. But this was a reminder that, in the wrong hands, they could just be turned into an even more syrupy version of normal music, if you like.
And I mean, this is such a good tune, you can't completely kill it.
No.
But there's nothing gained by removing any trace of a groove and replacing it with that on-the-beat school assembly piano and this sort of not the 9 o'clock news idea of what synth pop was.
Yeah.
It's not age well because it's neither an honest human statement nor a shiny electronic thrill. It just, like you say, it sounds like a demo of some new equipment that he's knocked up on a wet Wednesday. You know, it's not thought through. It's not really an attempt to create anything. It's completely unserious, but also completely humorless. Who cares? Like, the only conceivable human reaction is, so what?
So what? I mean, he plays the melody, like one-handed, in the instrumental break. And just how much better would it have been if, I don't know, he'd have done it with a dog bark sample or something like that. Total gimmickry. Whereas he's demonstrating the kind of classiness of these this kind of instrumentation. Yeah. And that's what's boring about it. And that's what's, you know, it's not Top of the Pops, is it, this? This is Afternoon Plus at best.
Oh, yes.
And the terrible thing is, they pumped out pipefuls of this shit.
Oh, yeah.
Dave Stewart and Barbara Gaskin
in
their folie à deux. Like, all through the 80s and 90s, even into this century.
Really?
They kept on getting stuck into these old songs, like Fred and Rose. They put out thousands of pointless CDs full of stupid electronic cover versions, released as albums just because they could. Mm. They kept putting out singles, too. There's a version of The Locomotion from 1986, a year before Kylie Minogue's somehow more successful version. Mm. And it sounds exactly as you would imagine a Dave Stewart and Barbara Gaskin cover of The Locomotion released in 1986 to sound like. Presumably he owned the studio, because there's no way they made a living from that. Mm. You know, that and working with Victor Lewis Smith, which is the other thing he did. At least it's an arresting contrast.
Mm.
He did the music for most of Victor Lewis Smith's shows.
So he did sing If You're Glad to Be Gay and the Doctor Who theme, which was a work of genius.
I would imagine that would be his handiwork,
But
it can't have been a living wage, right? And yet, I don't recall picking up a newspaper and seeing the headline on page 19, Dave Stewart starves to death.
No.
And in smaller print underneath, no, not that Dave Stewart, the other one. Passerby alerted authorities after seeing 105 bottles of milk on his doorstep and flies pouring out of the kitchen window because nobody cared. Mm. So, you know, he must have done better than me at least.
It's strangely dead emotionally, this song as well, for doing this song. It feels, the word is joyless, I think. Joyless in the making of it. Joyless in the performance of it. And you know, what personal satisfaction would you get from being part of this record? None whatsoever. You've taken a great song. And yeah, you've done very, very little with it, bar tart up the equipment a little bit. But you know, there is a lot of this. I mean, we've got another record in the charts from them, haven't we? And I mean, I'm intrigued as well by, apart from Dave, and Colin. Who else is on stage there?
Well, is that Barbara Gaskin off to the side, wearing the sort of jumpsuit Prince was fond of during Around the World in a Day?
It could be. The hair threw me off. The hair threw me off because it's not like she's in the video for the other song, but yeah, it may well be.
And you can definitely see this being on the portable telly in the dressing room of the Q-Tips and their lead singer looking at it and thinking, old Motown hits given an 80s sheen. Wonder what Pino Palladino's up to. Time to nip off to Burton's to get that flecked grey suit I've been looking at. Anything else to say about this?
No, and the fact that I've got nothing else to say about it angers me in itself.
So, the following week, what becomes of the broken-hearted soared 11 places to number 19, and a fortnight later began a two-week stand at number 13. Blundstone's follow-up, a synthy cover of Tracks of My Tears, would only get to number 16 June of 1982, by which time he'd joined the Alan Parsons Project, and in 1984 he teamed up with David Paton and other APP members to form the rock band Keats. He's still active today, working with Rod Argent and making occasional appearances in Manfred Mann. Meanwhile, Stewart repeated the trick when he teamed up with Barbara Gaskin and put out a cover of It's My Party, which got to number one for 4 weeks in October of this year. 4 weeks.
I wouldn't mind it if they weren't picking such great songs to cover, but just they're sucking any resonance that they once had out of them.
Welcome to the 80s, Neil.
Indeed.
No, pop craze youngsters, we're going to step away from this episode, catch us breaths and come back hard tomorrow, because we've got some big names coming up. Don't forget, if you want to see me, Neil and Taylor in the flesh at the London Podcast Festival, do not fanny about. Get your arse over to kingsplace.co.uk now and get your tickets sorted. So, until we meet again for part 3 of Chart Music number 71, and on behalf of Neil Kulkarni and Taylor Parks, this is Al Needham imploring you to stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.